We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to the second hour of Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frayne, is at the controls. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about Ireland and its politics and economy. It wasn't that long ago that Ireland was considered to be one of the most economically backward countries in the developed world. Now, that began to change in the 1980s, and by the 90s, the Irish economy was booming. Foreign investment was pouring in. They were calling it the Celtic Tiger, and people were pointing to Ireland as a model for other countries to emulate. However, when the global financial crash of 2008 arrived, it hit Ireland harder than almost any other place. We'll try to talk a little bit this morning about how and why it happened. And our guest for the program is Irish journalist Fintan O'Toole. He's author of a recently published book that is recent here in the United States. The topic of the title of his book is Ship of Fools: How Stupidity and Corruption Sank the Celtic Tiger. It's published by Public Affairs. Fintan O'Toole is columnist and critic for the Irish Times. He was elected Irish Journalist of the Year in 1993. He served as the drama critic for the New York Daily News from 1997 until 2001. He's authored a number of books and is a frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books, Granta, and other publications. He makes his home in Dublin, but right at the moment he's spending time in the United States talking about his book, Ship of Fools. And in fact, today he's in Chicago, where he'll be giving a talk sponsored by the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. As we talk, questions are welcome. People who are listening are certainly welcome to share their thoughts. You can do that by calling us at 333-9455. That's if you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. We have a toll-free line, so if it would be long-distance call, use that, and that's 800-222-9455. You may also email your comments to will-talk, so that is W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu, and at any point here, certainly, your participation is welcome. Mr. O'Toole, hello.
Good morning, David.
Thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate
it.
You've been writing, I think, about some of these concerns about the Irish economy. You'd been writing about that for a long time, and I think within Ireland had gotten a fair amount of criticism, at least from, I'm sure, from people in the world of government and business. Do you feel now that you can say, you know, I told you about this, and you weren't paying attention to me?
Well, unfortunately, there's no pleasure in being able to do that because this is very real, you know, and it sort of hurts an awful lot of people. You know, I'm a parent. I've got kids in their early 20s who are kind of facing out into this, you know, pretty catastrophic economic situation. And it's very sad, you know. I mean, Ireland is a really lucky country in one way, which is, you know, there's huge goodwill around the world towards Ireland, I think, for all sorts of historic reasons and because the Irish are everywhere. And, you know, people are probably aware of the fact that Ireland was very unusually economically underdeveloped for a Western European country. So, as you said in your introduction, you know, when I started writing, say, for the Irish Times in the late 1980s, you know, Ireland had its sort of per capita income was about two-thirds of the average in the European Union, of which Ireland was a part. So that was, you know, really quite an astonishing gap. And at the same time, we were still exporting huge numbers of our very talented, very well-educated young people. They were going to the States, they were going to Canada, they were going to Britain, they were going to Australia. And a lot of that talent that was there and always has been there was being lost. So it was a very depressing time. And then gradually, by about the mid-1990s, by about 1995, you know, things were really looking good. There was an incredible historic opportunity because we had the economic boom, which we can talk about. But also, you have to remember, there was also the Northern Ireland peace process was beginning. There was a sense of hope. There was a sense that, you know, these sort of historic legacies of underdevelopment and conflict were really beginning to be put into the past, and that you know, at a very simple level, the test for Irish people was, you know, if you were a young person, could you stay at home? Could you make a decent living in your own country? And for a whole generation of young Irish people, they just made that assumption. They didn't even have to think about it. Of course they could stay in Ireland. There was work, there was prospects, there was opportunities. If they went abroad, it was because they chose to do so, to travel. But, you know, they didn't feel they were being forced out. And the sad thing really is now that we're back into a situation where I know my own kids are thinking about leaving. And you know, that's pretty difficult to take when you think about the opportunity we had and how that opportunity was squandered.
Yeah. One of the arguments that you make is that when the Irish economy really started doing well at this period that you're talking about, that was made possible by a number of factors operating that made that possible. But you're saying in some ways that was really Ireland catching up to where it should have been all along, and that in fact, in spite of the fact that people in government like to take credit, that it probably wasn't really the direct result of any deliberate economic planning that anybody did.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, these things are always complicated when you get that sort of very profound economic and social and cultural change, indeed. There's no doubt that governments played a pretty significant role in it, I think particularly by investing in education. You know, when you were coming into the 1990s, and, you know, we were all aware that you were shifting towards a much more high-tech, smart economy, then some of the things that, you know, had been disadvantages for Ireland, like that it didn't really have the Industrial Revolution, it didn't have a lot of kind of classic old industry, that became an advantage, of course, because, you know, having all those old industries was a real drag on a lot of more developed countries. You know, they suddenly had to face, well, what are we going to do with our steelworks, and what are we going to do with our coal mines, and what are we going to do with our shipbuilding industries? I mean, Ireland didn't have any of that sort of stuff, so it was kind of free in some ways to almost skip ahead straight to the next phase, which was a high-tech, knowledge-based economy. And it had the young people and had the highly educated workforce to do that. And, of course, governments, you know, should take some credit for that. But a lot of it, as you say, was a mixture of kind of conjunction of factors that nobody could have really predicted. I mean, one of them was simply that the 1990s was an incredible period of growth in world trade, and of course, particularly here in the States, it was the period of, you know, the huge, the long IT-fed boom, which produced a vast amount of wealth and a vast amount of wealth looking to invest, and particularly for American companies wanting to export into Europe. Ireland became very attractive because they could say, well, like, here's an English-speaking country with a highly educated workforce, with reasonably competitive wage rates, good tax regime, and so there was just an awful lot of investment. So Ireland got a lot of this investment from Intel, from Microsoft, from IBM, also in the pharmaceutical industries. You know, all the Viagra in the world is made in Ireland. You know, and this wasn't stuff we did really. It was international investments coming in, and we were able to take advantage of that. But there were also, you know, big long term factors like demographics, for example. You know, we just happen to have a very, very young population for historic reasons, because, one of the sort of grotesque ironies in a way was we exported so many people in the 1950s that a lot of the people, you know, the elderly Irish people were actually not in Ireland. You know, they were in the United States, or they were particularly in Britain. So we actually ended up with a very young population, a lot of people coming into the workforce of working age, and a lot of women coming into the workforce, because, you know, traditionally, because it was a very Catholic, very conservative country, you know, women, particularly when they got married, stayed at home, and, you know, that had sort of big economic effects. So social change in the religious culture, all of those kind of things were feeding into what started to happen in the 1990s. And for about, I suppose you could say, for about 7 years, it was overwhelmingly positive. You know, so what was being generated was real growth. It had sort of a real basis in what was happening in the society, and it was very positive. It was creating a lot of jobs. Unemployment, which had been an enormous problem, you know, we'd had unemployment of almost 20% at one point. That was being brought down to 3% and 4%. We were getting growth rates of 8%, 9%, 10% a year. And a lot of that growth was based on real exports. So it was about actually, you know, stuffing made in Ireland and being exported around the world. So it was real, and it actually had, you know, a really kind of positive psychological effect on Ireland for people of my generation. You know, I'm 52, but, you know, people of my generation being in the 40s at that time, you know, it really felt like, that's it, it's over. You know, all this sort of terrible burden of failure and underdevelopment has finished, and the future looked very, very bright.
Yeah. At the same time, you seem to be saying that though, what people in government were saying when they were talking about what was going on and why this was going on, it was they were talking about their policies that were very pro-business, that were low tax, that had a very light hand on regulation. They were saying, well, that was the reason for the success. And they were going around the world saying, and if you just saying it in other countries, if you just did it like we do it, you could have this kind of success. It seems that what you're saying is that actually those things were, there were other factors that were maybe more important, and the sort of enthusiasm for that kind of package, that pro-business, low-tax, light regulation thing, really prevented people from actually understanding what the real contributing factors to this period of prosperity were.
Exactly. You know, one of the things that happens, and was kind of tragic, is that if you don't understand why you've become successful, then you don't really understand what you need to do to stay successful. And what happened in the Irish case was slightly surreal, if you were Irish, right? Which was that instead of being this kind of very complex place which had become successful for very complex reasons, we started telling ourselves a story about what had happened. And this story was sort of picked up internationally and echoed back to us, including from the United States. So what you got was, for a certain kind of way of looking at the world, what had happened in Ireland began to look like a sort of moral tale, and a very simple tale rather than a complex one. And that tale was, you know, summed up in a very kind of basic message about globalization, that, you know, globalization works, and it works in ways that are to do with a kind of formula. If you cut taxes and you have very light regulation, then the money will flow in and you will be successful. And that this has nothing to do with Ireland as such. It's a kind of magic formula that you could reproduce almost anywhere in the world, regardless of history, regardless of politics, regardless of culture. And the problem wasn't so much that Irish politicians started to spout this kind of mantra, but that they actually believed it. You know, that they kind of liked the idea that, you know, because Ireland had been so marginal and it's had such a sense of failure for so long, you know, it was very flattering to have even people in the United States saying, look at Ireland, look how wonderful Ireland is, look how fantastically well Ireland has performed. And this culminated, you know, I mean, you had John McCain, for example, in the presidential debates against Barack Obama, you know, was citing Ireland as a great example of success. Now, you know, for Irish people, that's very flattering. You know, we're sort of used to being the poor, unfortunate failures, you know, and to have a serious challenger for the United States presidency saying, you know, the Irish formula is the one that America should follow, you know, was a real change. So we started to believe this stuff. And the problem is when you start to believe it, then you start to apply it. And you start to forget about all the complex things that were going on. And particularly you start to forget about, I think, something really quite fundamental. And, you know, if there's a lesson from the Irish experience, it is that globalization isn't just about applying some kind of formula around the world. It actually has to take really serious account of the local factors, of the culture, of the politics, of the history, of the way in which a society itself interacts with these big global forces, and how it uses those global forces either positively or negatively. If it uses them positively, if it interacts with them, it can, to some extent, shape its own destiny. But if it doesn't do that, if it starts believing that, you know, that this is just a kind of magic formula that you can apply in a crude way, then you get the kind of disaster that you get in Ireland.
Our guest this morning is Fintan O'Toole. He's columnist and critic for the Irish Times. He is the author of a book that's just come out here in the United States, Ship of Fools, How Stupidity and Corruption Sank the Celtic Tigers, published by Public Affairs. He's in Chicago today and has been spending some time in the United States talking about the book and about Ireland. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Let's do that. Someone here in Champaign County where we are, in line one. Hello.
Hi. It's bracing to hear your critique of that snake oil that still seems to be saleable, at least around some academic milieus. I've witnessed a lot of it last night, actually. Forgive me if I've missed. Did you mention the money from the EU? I've heard the argument that there's two dimensions where the Ireland being in the EU helped a lot. One was this harmonization money. It was a fair amount. I guess it was used somewhat well. Didn't contribute directly to the building boom and the bubble that they had as well. And I'd like for you to describe that housing bubble there. But the other thing I heard was that a lot of reasons why these multinationals went to Ireland was because the UK didn't join the Eurozone, that it was Ireland was seen as a entree to the Eurozone with an English-speaking educated population and fairly low cost, so that Intel, Apple, and all these could still do assembly there, which they were doing for quite a while, it seems. So if you could address some of that.
Sure. Thanks very much for calling in. You're absolutely right about both of those things, and this is part of what tends to get left out, of course, in the very crude neoconservative use of Ireland, that Ireland is all about low taxes and light regulation. The fact is that actually Ireland's economic progress in the 1990s owed an awful lot to public money, and to intervention, and indeed to a certain solidarity, those kind of old-fashioned ideas that what happened really, particularly in the early 1990s, is you did have a lot of money coming into Ireland from the European Union. I mean, largely from, if you want to be crude about it, from the German taxpayer and the French taxpayer, and to a lesser extent the British and the Italian, but particularly the French and the Germans were putting a lot of money into Ireland. And a lot of that money, you're right to say, again, we don't want to sort of replace one crudity with another. That money didn't produce the Celtic Tiger, but it was very important, because what it was spent on really was infrastructure. I don't know if people have ever visited Ireland as visitors or tourists in the late 1980s or early 1990s. It was a very hard place to get around. It was very charming, but if you wanted to get from one side of the country to another, it's a very small country. It took you 4 or 5 hours because there were one lane, two lane roads, were your main highways. So that kind of infrastructural investment was really important, because it meant that actually when you did get economic growth, the strain was very considerable on Irish infrastructure, and Irish infrastructure is still very underdeveloped, but it would have been much more underdeveloped without European money going into it. And you're also right about the context of the euro, the Ireland being in the eurozone certainly was a huge attraction for a lot of the American investment coming in. Ireland was attracting this investment because if something was manufactured in Ireland or developed in Ireland, it then sort of benefited from not having tariff barriers in terms of getting into the European market. And of course, it was also able to benefit from European trade with the rest of the world. So, a lot of these products were regarded then as European products, and it it was very attractive for American companies, and actually remains so. I mean, one of the few bright spots in Ireland at the moment is that most of the leading American companies who have invested in Ireland haven't pulled out. They're still there, and a lot of them still, for all the difficulties, still do find Ireland quite a good place to do business in. The real problem was with, and you mentioned the housing bubble, and maybe we should just talk about that a bit, because in a way I was trying to say you had sort of two stories or two booms. You had this kind of real boom that happened in the late 1990s. And then around, really kind of coinciding more or less with 9/11, where you had a contraction of American investment, you had a contraction of world trade, there was a real shock to the Irish system at that point. And that was a point at which we kind of really need to start thinking about, okay, what's the next step? How do we start not just bringing in the Intels and the Microsofts and all the Pfizers and all these sort of big multinational companies, but actually how do we start really developing an organic and indigenous system of innovation, which is going to make Ireland a really leading center for innovation in the 21st century? And we didn't do any of that. What we did instead was governments started pumping money into into a housing and property bubble. And we got this incredible bubble in Ireland, which really lasted from 2002 right up to 2008, in which, you know, there were huge government incentives going into building more and more houses, into inflating the price of land, inflating the price of property. And what happened then was that instead of it being based on real industry and, you know, real growth and real exports, a lot of the growth over those 60 years was really based on debt. So you got a massive kind of infusion of credit, people borrowing vast amounts of money to build or buy a house. The prices of those houses just going up and up and up, and people borrowing more and more and more money. You've got a situation where today, just figures out today, actually, from the Irish Central Bank, show that, you know, overall debt in Ireland is about $1.4 trillion. That's $1.4 trillion. Now, this is in a country of 4 million people, you know, so that gives you, that includes corporate debt and a lot of other things, but it still gives you a sense of just how much debt was used to fuel a boom that was completely unsustainable. And it's the crash of that property boom, the bursting of that bubble, that's really left us in the terrible mess that we're in.
And I think one of the things, again, you make this argument that if you're really going to understand what happened in Ireland about the boom and the bust, you really need to understand the way Irish people think about things, Irish culture, Irish politics. And one of the points that you make is that if there's one thing that Irish people believe in, and that's land.
Yeah, but one of the extraordinary things was, you know, that and this is where, again, we have to sort of think about globalization as being quite a complicated phenomenon, you know, which is that in Ireland, I mean, Ireland became the most globalized society in the world in the early 21st century. You know, there was a very good index of globalization that's done in the States every year. And for about 3 or 4 years running in the early 21st century, I mean, Ireland was ranked number one. So that's incredible. If you know, you go within 20 years from being a kind of economic backwater to being the cutting edge of economic globalization. And you would think then, if that happens, then a lot of other things need to change in terms of the way you think, in terms of the way your society functions, in terms of the way your politics function. And the weird thing was that because a lot of our interaction with globalization came from the outside, you know, it was big companies coming in, we didn't actually change our culture or change our politics very much in order to be able to deal with all of these very big transformations that were happening in the economy and in society. And part of this was, as you said, I mean, if you want to take a simple example of this, was you would almost say that a lot of the Irish mentality in some ways remained 19th century or even going back to feudal times, you know, because there was still an obsession with land. Everybody wants to buy a house. And the price of houses in Ireland became so incredibly expensive because the land that the house sat on was also incredibly expensive. And, you know, so you had an almost kind of feudal society in which the things that determined what people were paying, where they were putting their money, was land, you know, in the same way as almost like, you know, going way back before the Industrial Revolution. And a huge amount of the energy of Irish entrepreneurs, Irish business, Irish risk takers was in property development. So instead of saying, okay, we've got all these, you know, world-leading high-tech and chemical and biochemical companies around, how do we develop a really interesting Irish infrastructure around high-tech companies and biomedics and all those kind of things? Instead of doing that, what the, you know, the majority of the sort of the wealthy class in Ireland were interested in doing was, how can I build? How can I develop this property? How can I speculate in land? So you had Irish developers, not just in Ireland, but going around the world, you know, borrowing increasingly extraordinary amounts of money to indulge in increasingly crazy kind of projects, which were almost driven by this sort of obsession with wealth being in bricks and mortar and land rather than wealth being in innovation and the creation of actual traded products. And that really, I suppose this is where the politics comes into it, you know, that part of what we have to kind of face up to in Ireland is that one of the reasons why we allowed this to happen was political. It was that sort of class of very wealthy landowners and property speculators were very much tied in with the ruling political party. And this is where the kind of corruption actually becomes quite important, because the sense in which the interests of a pretty small group of people who didn't even represent the sort of real productive wealth in the country, but rather represent this kind of speculative wealth, the interests of those people seemed to be paramount. And a lot of government policy suddenly became oriented effectively to the interests of those people rather than to the interests of the society as a whole.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus, Fintan O'Toole. He's columnist and critic for the Irish Times. He's the author of a number of books, frequent contributor to the New York Review of Books, Granta, other publications. His most recent book, just published here in the United States, is Ship of Fools, the subtitle How Stupidity and Corruption Sank the Celtic Tiger. It's published by Public Affairs. He's spending some time in the United States talking about the book, and in fact, he's in Chicago, where he'll be giving today a talk sponsored by the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Here on our program, we have a caller ready to go, and others are welcome. 333-9455 is the number. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. The next caller is in Altamont, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
I think your presentation is quite interesting and accurate, but I can understand that this dramatic rise of Ireland and the situation that occurred, the timing and so on, and the speculation. But I think this pattern of speculation is it's been demonstrated in throughout history and throughout even in the American situation with the building of. Of buildings and houses and so on. But I think that this is a typical pattern that I really don't think it's unusual. And I think that Ireland is probably going to have some problems, not only with their debt, but people moving to lower labor markets like China and Asia. It's unfortunate because I've been to Ireland. It's a wonderful country, but I think it's a typical pattern that we see with speculation that happens when a country rapidly advances and things are doing well and people have money, and then they think they got more money than they have, or that their future looks brighter than it might really be. And I'd like to hear your comments. Thank you.
Right. That's a really good point. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. I think it's a really important point you make, actually, because. You know, I'm not trying to get across the idea that Ireland was somehow unique. In some ways, on the contrary, I suppose what I'm trying to suggest is that, you know, you're absolutely right about these patterns. You know, these property booms and busts have happened over and over again in different societies. And really what makes me angry is that we didn't learn from this, you know, that what was happening by about, you know, about 2002-2003, anybody who was trying to look at this objectively could say, look, this is an illusion. I'll just give you a really simple example, right? So I live in a house in Dublin, which is a sort of, yeah, it's fine. It's, you know, I'm very happy with it. It's a, you know, it's small enough, three-bedroomed house in the inner suburbs of Dublin. We bought that house for the equivalent of about $100,000. We had it valued because we wanted to borrow some money, and a guy came and said, okay, it's worth $1 million. Now, just on a simple level, I know it's not worth $1 million. That's ridiculous. You know, it's complete madness. And if I was to sell it to somebody for $1 million, I would feel like I was actually, in some ways, you know, stealing money from that person because, you know, I know that this just is not sustainable. This, you know, this idea just cannot continue. But what's really interesting and kind of depressing, and this isn't about Ireland, you're right, about it's kind of about human nature in a way, but we all then want to believe this stuff, you know. So if somebody tells you your house is worth $1 million, you feel great, you know, and you feel rich. And even though your earnings, your actual income might be quite modest and you know, you might have a reasonably ordinary lifestyle, you suddenly start to feel, well, you know, I can afford to borrow some money because, you know, after all, my house is worth this, it was worth a fortune. And people start to behave as if they're very wealthy, even when they're not. And the sad thing is that in a small society like Ireland, where you know, everybody can see what's going on, it should have been possible for us to say, okay, let's put the brakes on here. Let's just stand back for a moment and stop this hysteria, because this is going to be quite damaging to us. And instead what happened was the opposite. And this, again, is where the culture matters a lot, actually. You know, is that this is where politics is really important. You know, there's a duty on politicians to stand up and say, look, I'm sorry, you know, you might not want to hear that your house isn't worth $1 million. You might want to hear that it's only worth, you know, 300 or 400,000, which is still quite a lot of money. But, you know, it's our duty as leaders in a society to be able to try and tell you these things. The economics profession, you know, we seem to have hundreds of thousands of economic experts in Ireland all of a sudden. Very, very few of them actually said, oh, by the way, you know, this is heading for a crash. And very interestingly, when, you know, one guy is a professor of economics in Dublin who is an expert in housing booms and bubbles, you know, that was his major subject. You know, he wrote a long piece in my own newspaper in the Irish Times saying this and saying, look, this is going to head for a crash and the crash is going to be really terrible because it's going to have really awful consequences for a lot of people. The reaction was, first of all, we got, you know, everybody in the property industry getting onto the newspaper saying, you know, if you ever publish anything like that again, we're not going to ever advertise with you. But then, you know, he was attacked by government. So the Prime Minister at the time, Bertie Ahern, said, you know, I don't know why these people just don't commit suicide. You know, a really terrible kind of comment, you know, saying, you know, these are just kind of depressed people who obviously just can't share in the optimism that should be out there. And very few of his colleagues in economics, you know, professional economists, actually supported this guy. Because what happened was, of course, the banks had acquired a vested interest in this boom continuing because they lent all this money and they were still lending vast amounts of money to these speculators to buy land, to build houses, to build office blocks. So the whole banking system had become dependent on this. And, you know, David mentioned earlier that I wasn't particularly popular in Ireland when you say some of these things, because people start saying, you get this thing that then happens, which is you're talking us into a depression. You know, if you tell the truth, if you actually say these things, then it's your fault, because if people lose confidence in the system, that itself will cause the collapse. And you get this kind of strange thing whereby a society lives a lie and really finds it very difficult to face up to what everybody actually deep in their heart knows to be true. And that's where the politics matters, that's where the culture matters, you know, the not just in Ireland, but, if, you know, if Ireland is kind of interesting at all, it's maybe as an extreme example of the way this sort of stuff happens. And it might then be an interesting case for other people to look at to say, you know, there's a lesson there. There's a lesson about self-delusion. There's a lesson about the lack of a clear sense of right and wrong sometimes. You know, a lot of this comes down to morality. It actually comes down to people saying, look, what's going on here is wrong. And it's kind of depressing how few people sometimes manage to say that. And even if they do say it, how little support they sometimes get.
Yeah. Well, and I think that another one of the points that you make in the book is something about the nature of Irish politics and its reliance on patronage and personal connections. And I know that you then go on to say, well, it's not necessarily the case that Ireland is somehow more corrupt than any place else, but that there was this notion that people felt that they could essentially do whatever they wanted to, and that even if they got caught, there would be no consequences for them to suffer.
That's the fatal thing. You know, as you say, I'm not saying that Ireland was by any means the most corrupt society in the world, or that political corruption is unique to Ireland. I don't know. I'm sure people in Chicago might have a few stories to tell about that. You know, so I'm not suggesting that at all. But the very distinctive thing about Ireland, I think, is because of this political culture, which was so intimate and where you had these kind of golden circles of people who were very connected to each other between business and politics, the real problem was impunity. You know, so corruption is always damaging, but it's much more damaging if you know about the corruption, if it's exposed, and then nothing happens. You're almost better sort of not knowing about it because, you know, it doesn't have quite the same effect, actually. But when you know about it, and a lot of good journalism was done in Ireland in the 1990s and the early part of the 21st century, exposing a lot of these things, and a lot of this led to the establishment of big, you know, tribunals of inquiry and all of this kind of stuff. And we got a lot of detail on this, and we discovered that, you know, two of our last three prime ministers were on the take, you know, were taking very large amounts of money, particularly a guy called Charles Haughey, who was the prime minister for for a lot of the 80s and into the early 1990s, and who kind of shaped a lot of the political culture. I mean, Hawke had taken, over the course of his political career, the equivalent of about $50 million, you know, so not small amounts of money. This is, again, in a very small society. So the problem was that we kind of exposed all of this sort of stuff, and then nobody went to jail. There were no real prosecutions for bribery, for massive tax evasion that went on, for you know, outright corruption. A lot of the planning process had been very badly corrupted, and that's actually fatal, because if you already have the kind of self-delusion that we were talking about, this kind of testosterone-fueled mania, you know, where people begin to think that, you know, everything is going to keep growing, and, you know, more and more money is going to be coming into the system, and so there's already, you know, a kind of hypercharged atmosphere, and you also have a very poor culture of public morality, you know, say in Irish banking, for example, quite poor standards of ethics. If you've already got all that, and then you have a sense of impunity, then you have a sense of, well, actually, it doesn't really matter, because even if you get caught, you're not going to go to jail. That actually becomes a pretty toxic kind of combination, because you then, as you say, you get people who feel, well, actually, it really doesn't matter what I do. And it doesn't even matter if I do something wrong and I get caught, because I'm still going to be able to get away with this sort of stuff, and I'm still going to be very rich, and I'm not even going to be have to be very ashamed about this. You know, one of our problems was that people continued to elect quite corrupt politicians. So even when politicians were found to have been engaged in fraud or in tax evasion, in most other societies, you know, that would be the end of your political career. Whereas in Ireland, in many cases, these people continued to stand for election and continued to get elected. And that actually sends out a really, really bad message, because it makes it very difficult for anybody who's in the business of trying to regulate, anybody who's in the business of trying to impose standards, finds themselves in a really difficult position, because they're really not being supported by the public in terms of demanding high standards. But they also know that a lot of these people are connected, and they're connected in ways that seem to give them a kind of impunity. So if you were an ordinary official, say, in the banking regulator, were you going to act against these people knowing that they had political connections, and knowing that even if you put your own neck on the line and try to expose this kind of stuff, then the likelihood is that they would get away with it and you might be the person who got to blame?
Let's talk with someone else. Lovington is another caller here, line one. Hello.
Morning. I guess you kind of, you hit on a lot of stuff that I was going to ask you about. What's the difference? I guess I got a comment then, that I wonder whether, I think you're saying maybe your society isn't quite as moral or something, but in our society, I mean, these guys made up games that generated book dollars. They took the book dollars into their own accounts, and now we are making the book dollars real because they were too big to fail. I mean, to me, that's, we don't even recognize the what's wrong with that. You know. Do you understand what my comment is?
I do. Completely. And I entirely agree with you. You know that. You know, we didn't. There's some difference in the way things worked in Ireland and in the States. You know, we didn't have these kind of derivatives, and very, very, very complex financial products weren't the problem. Ours was a kind of simpler one of housing. But you're absolutely right about this idea of the sort of the generation of false wealth. You know, so whether it's because, you know, these guys are packaging up subprime mortgages into these extraordinary derivative products, or as in the Irish case, whether it's, you know, claiming that something, a field somewhere, you know, which has a few cows on it, is suddenly worth millions of dollars, which we know it isn't. And you're right about that. There is this kind of process of generating notional wealth, which isn't real. And exactly what you say is true, that then when the whole thing crashes down, we, you know, the ordinary people, ordinary taxpayers, are left with not just, you know, actually sort of bail these people out, but actually making that unreal wealth real, because we end up paying them for these so-called assets. And the same thing has happened in Ireland. And I think people are very angry about it. And I think this is not just an Irish phenomenon. I think it's a kind of, it's a phenomenon around the Western world, you know, that I think huge damage has been done to the public's sense of right and wrong, you know. And I mean, I don't want to sound simplistic about this, but, you know, if you don't have a society in which there's a basic level of trust, And if that level of trust isn't based on the view that actually most people, you know, most people adhere to a sense of what's right and a sense of what's wrong, if you don't have those sort of things, then it actually is really corrosive of not just the society, but also the economy. And economies can't work without trust. And I think what we're doing, by and large, around the Western world in you know, bailing out all of these people and in transferring massive amount of wealth from the people who didn't cause the problems, but in many ways were victims of the problems, but transferring wealth from them to the people who did cause the problem, is actually very, very damaging in the long term. And I think, you know, our political systems are really faced with an enormous challenge, which is how do you persuade people that some kind of right and wrong exists, that there's some correlation between risk and reward, that there's some correlation between doing wrong and being punished for it. How do you persuade people of all of those kind of things when at the same time, you know, they can see that very often what's happening is that you know, quite ordinary, decent people are really having to pick up the tab for the behavior of completely irresponsible elites.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Fintan O'Toole. He's a columnist and critic for the Irish Times. He is the author of a recent book here that's come out in the United States, Ship of Fools, How Stupidity and Corruption Sank the Celtic Tiger, published by Public Affairs. We're talking about what's happened in the Irish economy recently, particularly as it was very hard hit by the 2008 global economic downturn. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Something else that I'm interested in having you talk about, this seems particularly ironic in that the boom in Ireland was really led by innovation in information technology. You, one of the things that you argue, one of the ways in which the country seemed to be in the 21st century but with a 19th century mindset, is that there was this huge failure to really to come to grips with technology.
Yeah, it's sort of hard to believe when you look back on it. You know, we had, you know, I mean, Ireland still has, you know, not just it started out with a kind of fairly sort of basic assembly of computers, but it moved very rapidly beyond that. So, you know, most of the major global IT companies have their European research and development centers in Ireland. You know, so in Dublin has, you know, Google would have its R&D center. So would Microsoft, you know. So there's a lot of cutting-edge technology happening in Ireland. And the best of the, you know, Irish graduates are really, you know, absolutely top class and are involved in that process. And but the real failure was that the society as a whole never really thought about this and never really took this on board in terms of what its future would be. And there's a very simple way of explaining this, I think. If you were in the 19th century and you were in Dublin and you asked a typical middle-class Dublin family what did they want their kids to be, they would have said doctors and lawyers. And if you were in Dublin in 2005, 2006, and you asked you know, a similarly typical middle-class couple what did they want their kids to be, they would have said doctors and lawyers. You know, they wouldn't have said scientists, mathematicians, IT specialists, any of that stuff, you know. So in Ireland, we've got a system of entry into sort of level education, you know, where you sit sort of state examinations and then you get points. And the points that you needed to become a doctor were about sort of three times what you needed to become a computer scientist, you know, and that's based on demand for courses. So, you know, the aspirations really didn't change. And we didn't really do a good job of teaching information technology in school, teaching mathematics in school, and really kind of engaging with this process. You know, and I'm not suggesting that everybody in Ireland suddenly needed to become a computer engineer. Of course they didn't. But you need a society which has a capacity to engage with the forces that are shaping it. And if you are not producing a culture that's sort of mathematically literate, that, you know, is completely at ease with all of this technology, then it's very hard for you to make good decisions about, you know, what your future is. I mean, if you look at broadband, for example, it's the really sort of classic example of this, you know, because, again, when you got the sort of ideology that came on top of all this sort of stuff, that the market would provide everything. So the Irish government said, quite rightly, you know, in around the turn of the century, said, look, Ireland needs to be one of the top 10 countries in the world for broadband access, which was absolutely true. We did. If we were going to place ourselves as a sort of top-class IT economy, then that was kind of obvious. We're still really way down the list. I mean, you don't have good access to broadband in Ireland. Why do you not have good access? Because then within this myth, well, you know, we need this stuff, but the market will somehow provide it. Now, in a small country, which has a scattered population with a lot of people living in rural areas, the market's never going to provide this. It actually needed, you know, quite strategic state investment to achieve some of this sort of stuff. But there was a sense that, say, politicians, for example, didn't really understand the importance of it because the politicians themselves had no understanding of the ways in which an information technology society might be shaped. So there was a lot of rhetoric about it, but really not very much understanding of what was going on.
Yeah. It's something else that's maybe related. I guess I'm thinking also overall about who, during the time that things were booming, who was it that benefited? And it seems that a small number of people in the business community, people in politics benefited. And even at the time when people were feeling really good about the country, when the levels of confidence were very high, people were very optimistic, there was a lot of money there that could have been spent by government on social good, that it wasn't done.
That's the real tragedy, you know, that we were running budget surpluses for a lot of this time. You know, the government really had more revenue than it knew what to do with. And the real tragedy is you know, it's a very small society. It's as a lot of your callers, I mean, and, you know, quite nicely said, it's a really good place. You know, it's a lovely place, lovely country. You know, has you know, great traditions within the country, great innovation. If you look at Irish record in terms of the arts, in terms of literature, you know, I mean, I think Ireland has kind of disproportionately contributed a lot to the world. So, you know, it's a place that has just fantastic potential, but really needed serious long-term investment in people and in infrastructure, but particularly in people, actually. You know, it needed not to get complacent, you know, that so because education had been very important in attracting companies in the 1990s, we kind of said, okay, well, we're obviously great, we've got a great education system, all these companies come in, but of course it's not like that. It's a rapidly changing world. You know, you need to go to the next level and to keep investing. And this is, I think, one of the really sad things is that we failed to do this. So you got still a lot of inequality in the society. You got a lot of people who didn't really benefit greatly from all the wealth that was around. And at the same time, you got this sort of self-delusion that, you know, we are rich. You know, this is the way people felt. And what you're getting now is that, you know, even a lot of the investment that was made is now being cut back. So a lot of the communities who didn't do very well out of the boom time were maybe just beginning to get some benefits just at the time when the tap was turned off and the money is drying up. And, you know, so I suppose my simple point is that one of the lessons of Ireland is that if you do have the opportunities, you need the values to go with them. You actually need politics to generate real choices, and you need to be able to say, okay, what kind of society do we want, and how are we going to get there? And you have to do that with a certain kind of clarity of mind and a certain ruthlessness in terms of pushing it through and saying, okay, you know, these are the basic standards that we want. And you really need values. You really, really need, you know, and you come back to a sense of, you know, what's right and what's wrong, and what kind of values should a 21st century society aspire to. Mm-hmm. And I think we failed to articulate that for ourselves.
We're coming to the point here, we just have a couple of minutes left. From what I understand, things at least are in Ireland are improving maybe very slightly, in the sense that at the end of last year there was a pretty small, but at least there was a rise in GDP. And while the unemployment is still high, the pace of growth in unemployment has slowed. And I wonder does that lead people to think, well, okay, we're in a bad time here. It's been a massive correction, but things will turn around and essentially things will maybe get closer back to the way that they were.
Well, I think there's maybe two views. I mean, I think certainly there's an official view which would say, you know, if we just take a lot of pain now and put a lot of money into the banks, put a lot of money into kind of cleaning up the mess that's been left behind, then we can get back to the way we were. I think for most people, actually, they're saying, well, actually, we don't want to go back to the way we were. You know, that the way we were wasn't sustainable and it wasn't really producing the kind of long-term change that's necessary in a society like Ireland. So I suppose, as in a lot of societies, there's a tension between a desire on the part of some people to say it'll be okay. We'll just, you know, we'll weather this storm, and the Celtic Tiger will roam again. And on the other hand, I think a lot of people, and I would certainly be one of them, were saying, look, you know, that's not a place we want to go back to, because it didn't really produce the goods. Economic growth for its own sake, I mean, simply turning around at the end of every year and saying we've got 10% economic growth doesn't really mean very much if you're not producing tangible improvements in the lives of ordinary people. And what I would be saying very strongly is, you know, that in order to get out of where we are, and I think we can get out of where we are, I mean, I'm actually, you know, optimistic about Ireland, because I do think it's still a good place. But to get out of where we are, I think, you know, we actually need to say that the experience we've been through should be a chastening experience. So we should understand that we need to really change our culture, change our political system. We need to acquire a very strong sense of public morality and a very strong sense of vision. You know, we actually need to kind of set some goals and set about meeting them. And I think if we do that, we're perfectly capable of doing it.
All right, there we'll have to leave it. Fintan O'Toole is our guest. He's columnist and critic for the Irish Times. His book is Ship of Fools, and it's published by Public Affairs Books. He's in Chicago. We'll be speaking at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs today. Mr. O'Toole, thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed, David. Thank you very much to the callers as well.